Welcome to Unstoppable Talk. I'm Sam Schutte, the host of the show and CEO of Unstoppable Software. In this show, we talk about business innovation with some of the brightest leaders in their fields, people who are achieving greatness, changing markets for the better, and bringing new products and services to their customers. Is your business struggling to implement digital marketing? In today's show, we have Sarah Tsai, and she's with Sarah Tsai Consulting. She has consulted with Fortune 500 companies as well as lean organizations to custom tailor business solutions. We're going to discuss change management within operations and how to successfully integrate digital marketing and culture. Welcome to the show, Sarah. So, Sarah, tell us a little about your company and how you got started.
I started my company in 2017, where I've experienced not great experiences in corporate life and working for other people. I was very disappointed in the way that companies are structured, the politics are played out, the dominant male hierarchy a lot of times in these organizations. And so I started my company actually initially just as a freelancer, working as an independent consultant in different organizations. Once I got in and kind of understood the problem, I was able to bring more custom tailored solutions, bringing additional team members, and figure out how to structure, whether it's an employee-employer arrangement or an independent contractor arrangement with others. And then gradually, you know, went from like maybe a $10,000 website dev to a $350,000 engagement of a full stack build over time. So I would say if I started in July 2017 and we're at 2020 May, approaching 3 years, it's been a thrilling and fun ride. So that's how I got started.
Gotcha. You mentioned getting inside that organization and figuring things out. What were some of your techniques and important things you learned there?
So just a little bit more about my background. I'm 43 years old. You wouldn't know looking at me. I look like I'm in my 20s and a petite 5 feet Asian woman. But I've worked 7 years as a management consultant, have actually worked with PepsiCo, Pfizer, GlaxoSmithKline, a lot of the CPG, pharma, you know, Fortune 100s. As well as have been boots on the ground with small businesses that are very lean, have maybe no more than $60,000 for either an in-house hire of a marketing salesperson or need to employ software and hire an agency within that sort of budget. So the way I've scaled my business and grown is, first of all, you have to be very clear on the value you're providing a client. So when we were working with Fortune 500s, you know, there's agencies pitching all the time, another market research firm, you know, everybody wants a piece of that pie as, you know, your first tier, second tier service provider. And you just have to really clearly articulate what the objective is and how to get there. And then for some of the smaller businesses, because their budget is so lean and they want immediate results, then you can't say, well, we're going to deliver this value and you're going to get these types of insights and hopefully it'll help you make this decision. You have to say, okay, this is what you can see and touch. And this is what we're going to build. And you're going to get it in 2 weeks or 2 months. So having that sort of project management approach, like the curiosity of a consultant, but also being able to be flexible on how you deliver the execution and the process is how I've managed to continuously win business. I can give you two examples, one from a Fortune, you know, big company, and the other one from a small company. So people like to work with people they know and have already done business with. So in the case of a large Fortune 500 company, we went in just kind of connecting some of the dots for them from a consulting perspective and actually working with IERG, you know, diversity groups and trying to help them manage their membership list. And then we, as a result, was able to talk to their IT manager, and then kind of went into different aspects of the different logistics business, and then, you know, helped them develop or refine their purchasing software. And also eventually where we are now is we're actually helping them adopt certain enterprise-wide machine learning know-how, best practices. So that trust was built over time. And as you get to know other stakeholders within a big company, that's how we managed to grow and continue to win additional business. And then from a small company, my friend got hired. He was, I don't know how many of you guys are in the Cincinnati area, but he went to country, I don't know if it was like Country Day or one of the, Cenex, so it was all boys school. And then so he got hired by this multi-site facilities management company and just thought their website was hideous. So I went in and redid the website and they're like, well, how about mobile app? And I'm thinking, okay, I've done that before. I facilitated that. So I put a team together to build them a mobile app, which if you think about it, I went in sort of as a marketing consulting agency doing a digital delivery. Then we sort of 3X that contract in the mobile app, really went into their operations and service delivery. And now that the app is done, we're really helping them roll out and servicing their customers, and some of their customers may be interested in adopting the app. So we actually help them with their business development, and and big companies, they'll call it R&D. But when you're, small firm, 20 people, you don't have an R&D department, you're not investing in new, net new research. So that's been really fun, is to go into these organizations and just say, okay, what do you have for me? What are your problems? And we try to solve them one at a time.
Yeah, I'm curious. You mentioned earlier talking about kind of the value equation for helping them solve the value equation for why they might want to do something with you in big companies and small companies. Have you noticed that that's different or more challenging between a big company and a small company, them figuring out what's in it for them? Or have you seen that one is harder than the other to try to justify the value?
That's such a great question, Sam. Big companies have cumbersome systems. They're slower to move, but they have ample resources. So they kind of allocate, this budget to this project, this budget to this project. And sometimes there's multiple projects that's solving the same problem, but it really is very hard to see how you move the needle. Smaller companies are more agile. Sometimes it's just the owner nodding their head and writing a check saying yes. And they can implement quickly, but sometimes the nuances of, getting the stakeholder to understand what is needed. Like one of our biggest challenges delivering this mobile app was user testing. In big companies, I would hire people to test this mobile app, but because we did it so lean and on a budget for this small company, we needed their sales director, their vendors onboarded, their vendors, technicians to actually test the app, and also the stakeholder, right? The COO, the CEO, to try it and give us feedback. And they couldn't articulate the problem. Like they give up when, the photo function doesn't work, or what is my login? Send them the login for the 10th time. And, just to say, okay, this is a critical part of us finishing this work. Sometimes in smaller organizations, it's harder to get buy-in and get them focused on the task, or they might think, hey, this is your role. You're supposed to, define the complete parameters. Whereas sometimes in larger companies, you just have people who are more well-versed in the delivery process and mechanism.
Yeah, absolutely. And you had mentioned before the show, we were talking about how important it is to have a tailored solution nowadays. How do you connect that to value, or how do you think that relates to value?
So, like I said, I'm 43 years old. When I started, after graduate school, I was 24 when I entered the workforce. And what I had learned over the last 20 years is that a lot of our systems are legacy system from the industrialized era. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the Ford Motor Company, the best way to gain efficiency is how to make that car cheaply, inexpensively, and you look at people slash labor as an expense. But in today's digital era, or some would say we're sort of in this machine learning post-digital era, we need to define the problem better and the solutions better. And people are not as dispensable as they were before, because you can't always standardize everything. And a lot of the problem came from us wanting to train monkeys to do a monkey's job. But the new problems and competition will come up. And then the stakeholders in these organizations are like, well, I can't believe this is looking at me in the face. So, you know, in the day of innovation, you are looking at disruptors. You're looking at people who's never entered a certain industry before gaining traction. You're looking at, you know, people graduating high school and coming up with a great idea and being able to make lots of money. I mean, heck, you're looking at the toy review kid that's making $6 million a year, right? So what is the point of school? What is the point of standardization? What is the point of making everything the same? That is going to be debunked very quickly, especially with machine learning up and coming, you know, robotic machine learning, anything that can be learned, trained, standardized can maybe be replaced. Mm-hmm. So we really have to think in a very agile way, in a very futuristic way, on not just how we define business solutions, but how we treat people and how we retain value and exchange value with our customers. I think we're just seeing a lot of minor changes within a bigger sea change context. And that's what I've been seeing in the 20 years of my career. I really wanted to go into a job and take up a role and just think that if I worked hard enough, that it would get me somewhere and deliver certain value. But I've had to sort of look at the deficiency in defining that role and also the overall organization deficiency to kind of move forward as a team and then just jump out of that systematic thinking and think, okay, what is the bigger picture here? Why does this company exist? Who are we solving problems for? What is our role in the broader ecosystem? And then are there points of leverage between the different ecosystems? And think in that way is, I think, what the future needs and what organizational leaders need.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, that concept of purpose, I guess, you know, like you said, what is this company for? What is its role? It's amazing how many people can lose sight of that so easily, you know, and the company can become about, you know, what's in it for you and what it does for you. And you know what I mean? If you're on a dysfunctional team or if you're working around a dysfunctional team, often they've completely lost sight of what the company's mission is, right? What their mission is. And that can make all the difference, I think, you know, because to your point, the work that can't be automated, that, you know, high touch, you know, human work that needs to be done, you have to be on message with the mission to do that well, I think. Standard work, you know, it's almost like a little bit of a paradox, just really standardized stuff that's just rote, repetitive stuff. Maybe it's not as important that you understand the mission and the culture and the purpose and all that stuff, right? So it's like, as we move forward, that understanding that mission becomes more and more important.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you look at post-World War II, where a lot of countries were recovering, having a dishwasher, having a laundry machine, you know, fully stocked grocery store, those are the value exchange. And mm-hmm. those were things that people needed. So you look at Sears, JCPenney, and a lot of those department stores that were filling that need of material. there was a time where a company didn't have to have a purpose. They exist to provide goods and services. There was no social media. It wasn't all about who the influencers were and who's saying what on media. It was literally people are trying to feed their kids and send them to school. And people are trying to send their kids to college. People are trying to make a better life for themselves. But I think, you know, what is the disconnect is that we're well beyond that. You can set up an e-commerce store. If you have a product to sell, you have a great message, and there's software tools that's pre-made for you to be successful. And that was not the case before the internet, before social media. It was, you know, let's hire an agency to produce a Super Bowl ad, right? And then so the only people or companies are able to make these advertisements were the Procter & Gamble's, the Pepsi of the world. Mm-hmm. But now everybody is their own media company. I mean, I have Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook. I can create a public figure page in 2 seconds. So it's a very crowded, noisy space for information. And that's what's different is that a lot of the companies and the institutions that are actually holding up, you know, the infrastructure of our livelihood haven't really evolved or figured out that that is the case, that information is important, that even if you're a B2B company, you need a great message because you're working with other people. And so I think that a lot of that thinking hasn't evolved.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I always think of like Coca-Cola, to your point of like post-World War II, you know, certainly when they first started, it's like, drink Coke, it tastes good. Well, we taste better than the others. Like, that's it, right? And even in our childhood or growing up, you know, it was they had the whole Pepsi challenge, you know, taste test. Like, the product tastes better. That was the message, right? But, you know, if you go on Coca-Cola's website today, it says, you know, together we can unite for the common good. I mean, that's their message. It's like you just have to scroll down pretty far before you find anything about the fact that they sell a soda drink, you know.
Like, yeah.
And I think it's all about that brand and that message, like you said, because they want, you know, they have figured out that the people associate some sort of positive good by being a fan of Coca-Cola. I don't know how true that is for everybody. I guess maybe it's very subconscious. I don't know. I guess I'm curious because a lot of the work that you do when you're working with customers, you've done a lot of work on cross-border projects. And when you look at branding, whether it's for an app or something else, some marketing they're trying to put out there, how do you have to sort of take into account cultural differences when you're trying to come up with that sort of a brand message?
So the cross-border e-commerce project, first of all, cross-border, meaning in the past, it takes you about 2 to 3 years to set up a production line and manufacturing facility in a foreign country, get the licenses to sell. Now with e-commerce, you can actually try it on their sort of e-commerce platform and list the information and then sell it across border. So your manufacturing facility might be in a different country, but you're able to still produce sales volume globally. So the project we took was with Mead Johnson. It's a infant milk formula brand. And the first thing that we had to figure out was, well, how do we speak to the Chinese consumer? Not that they didn't already have brand teams, boots on the ground, but we were trying to launch sort of a brand ambassador campaign via social media. And we ended up delivering that via WeChat because in the United States, you have Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. But the Chinese WeChat is actually their one-stop social media source other than TikTok that's, you know, very up and coming. Mm-hmm. So we try to adhere to the brand voice, the care, the safety mechanisms. We sort of shared with them the importance of DHA and the various ingredients and the care that the brand had put into the infant milk formula. And as you know, China had a one baby policy for the longest time. So we used to say there would be about 8 adults per child, because you have the mom and dad, and then you have the grandparents on each side. So, you know, they obviously want the one child to have the best care. And so a lot of that was taken into account when we did the marketing campaign for Mead Johnson.
Yeah. So I guess in that, you know, in that set of circumstances, you know, the importance of children and their, and sort of their, I don't know, not to say that China values, you know, children more than the US or something, but maybe more emphasis on that message might sort of tie into the brand somehow, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely mission driven.
Yeah. Interesting. So how do you, when you're trying to find projects like this, or when you're looking at projects that you could do, how do you select which ones are the right fit for you?
We want to align the stakeholders' intentions and the value that they want to get out of it with our technical expertise. So there are many projects that we turn down that we feel like the stakeholders themselves are not aligned to what the final output needs to look like and what the value the tool can deliver. We also offer consulting services from a management consulting standpoint, because a problem well defined is a problem half solved. And a lot of times when you are leaders today, you don't have to know everything, but you should do your due diligence to understand who your competitors are, what space are you moving into to make an informed decision. So a lot of times we would recommend sort of a landscaping report or a customer sort of path to purchase report, or talk to other your competitors, retired executives, to kind of get a landscape for what you're solving for before you spend money on anything. So kind of take it up one level before you pay money for execution. And I think that that's how we select project, is that we want to make sure that what we're delivering is a value, that people can use it right away. And that also lends itself to customization. A lot of times you go in thinking it's a software build out, but really you have to have training as well. And sometimes they're like, oh, if you can just make these systems talk to each other or build out this process, we're like, oh, no, we need, you know, some extra funding for the UX and UI and test and redo some of the wireframes from time to time, just to continuously make it user friendly. And we also need, you know, some kind of consulting services add on to help with adoption. And I think a lot of, you know, IT leaders don't understand that there's also these different soft sets of needs that when you deploy a technology solution, you have to kind of broad stroke look at the end-to-end delivery of the tool.
Yeah. And even just, you know, because something I've started to see more companies do is like internal marketing about a new software system that they, you know, have developed to increase that adoption and engagement with customers, right?
That's exactly it. Yeah.
You know, and I don't think that was something that was done so much in the distant past, but I have seen, I mean, it's really indistinguishable from any other marketing campaign. It's just only your employees are seeing it. And, you know, people will have naming contests, you know, what should we call the system, all kinds of stuff you see out there, right? But I think it is key that, you know, it's an organizational change, right? If you're rolling out that kind of a system, it's not just, you know, we put something on a server or a website somewhere.
Yeah, if you look at the traditional IT director role, a lot of them grew up in the server room, a lot of them know the hardware. And then when you think about software, it's like, just make it work, right? If you, it's an invoicing system, it's a sort of lean manufacturing system, it's a product development system. It's not really connected to the front end of the customer or marketing, certainly not marketing to the internal stakeholders. But what we need to look at as IT leaders today is the data. There may be data from a customer service standpoint that will really help marketing and sales. There are data from, you know, sales leaders that they're just typing it into sales force that may be really helpful for the product development team. Because, you know, they're trying to sell and they're more familiar with who the competitors are. And so when you look at data, when you look at IT now owns a lot of this data, you can't just be wedded to your job description and the hardware that you maintain. You actually have to go outside of your comfort zone to try to learn new skills as to how to leverage this data and how to share it. And data is just data. We have to turn it into insights. So what is that, does that process look like? Those are dire needs in the marketplace today for more talent and more awareness.
So do you agree with something you often hear is that the data in a system can be more valuable than the system itself? Is that something you have seen?
Data is only valuable if there's actionable data. And there's several steps before that, which is how do you categorize and tag the data? How do you analyze the insights that come out of those tags? And are they categorically correct? And so it is a very complex process to architect that delivery mechanism. But again, we go back to those end-to-end solutions. What information is valuable to the stakeholder? And how do you look at the data to be able to extrapolate the insights, I think, are very critical need in the marketplace today.
Well, you're definitely right about actionable data. Can you give an example? I think that's something that people struggle with. Maybe can you give an example of something that a piece of data that's not actionable versus something that is actionable?
Oh my goodness. We're allowed to talk about coronavirus.
Yeah, sure. No, that's a
great
example.
What's not helpful is the mass amount of data that we're seeing. You know, how many cases, how many new cases, how many people died, right? That's really sort of a high level piques intrigue, but it doesn't address how is it transmitted. And on a personal level, like, you know, where are the clusters? Who's being affected? Are people who are dying that have comorbidities? Are there healthcare institutions in certain pockets of the community that's dealing with this better? How does contact tracing play into minimizing the spread? And does quarantine actually help? And what type of quarantine helps? So the insights come from making it actionable. And both you and I, who are not healthcare professionals, know like when some piece of information is helpful to me. For example, the kids are not affected as much, but they're carriers, right? We learned that from China. So whilst I keep my kids away from their grandparents, I'm actually letting them play with other children. In the case that they're that one in a million or whatever the stat is, it's less than 1% chance of them being on a ventilator. I am not going to worry about that as much as I would, you know, a different population that may get this more. So that is a very good example of actionable data, in my opinion, in terms of how it may affect what you do on a daily basis in a way that you can understand.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think and a good example, even with like the infection counts and death counts and stuff that we see or mortality counts, really said more officially, you know, I think it's a good example of what you see with a lot of data sets. There's just a raw number. And whether it's infection counts or mortality counts, or, you know, if you're a business, it might be your annual sales last year were X. That's not actionable, right? It doesn't tell you what to do about that or how to act. But in your example of infection counts, if you knew, for instance, a little more like background to that, like, well, where did they get it? We used contact tracing, and what percentage of those infection counts came from eating at a restaurant, for example, right? That might be actionable, because if it's 90%, you know, then we know we have a serious problem with restaurants. If it's 0.0001%, that changes what we might do in society a lot, right?
There you go. And so when executives look at sales numbers, they're not looking at your retention percentage. They're not looking at your path to purchase, how many people abandoned cart, and where you won back customers. And I think that's what causes sort of your middle managers and or your sort of frontline personnel a lot of frustration because you might have a team that's totally winning in terms of customer retention, or they built this awesome app that is helping engage lots of new customers, but they haven't gotten to year three where you're making the lifetime value back from this customer, right? Yeah. And then you're just looking at that one piece of data that is showing you some statistics and whether your sales have grown. So you do need to get more granular into the portions and the, you know, actionable data and data that actually gives you some insight into how your operations is doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the sales industry and just sales metrics in general can often be affected by that sort of mindset to a large degree. I mean, I've known, you know, recently a lot of salespeople that have been punished or let go even, you know, because basically just random guesses they made when it comes to like setting quotas and things like that were off, you know. When they have no information to go on, they're just throwing out a guess. You can't really hold them to that, right? And the reality is your sales could shrink, but still be better because maybe, maybe your sales shrunk, but they were better than any of your competitors. Or maybe they shrunk, but your profitability went up because you were selling less of the wrong thing, right?
Right.
I mean, there's so many ways to slice and dice it. And I think a lot of times sales managers and sales executives at organizations, they just look at that top level number. And certainly like marketing departments, I mean, they suffer the same thing. You know, how many website visitors did we get? Oh, we got 100,000. Last month we had 90,000. Great. We improved. Gold star. Well, I mean, you know, the simple things of how many of those were bots, you know, how many of those were, you know, teenagers that aren't your target market at all, right? I mean, you know, they need to drill in more into it to make any sense of that.
Yeah. And that goes back to what we initially talked about, the industrial era. You know, how many units of soap did you sell? You know, what's your profit margin with Walmart? Right now, I saw sort of 6 or 7 years ago, this huge pivot where we used to do these in-depth market research. We would sit people in a room and we would ask them what their experience is with their product. And you can spend thousands of dollars doing these types of market research, but all you have to do is go on Amazon and read the reviews.
Yeah.
You know, so we really do live in sort of a consumer-led democratic world where people have a lot to say about their user experience. And so that was not the case when in the industrial era, that all you could look at is this very top line numbers. You really do have to get into more granularity in terms of how you're winning, if you're winning, and what your competitors are doing.
Yeah. When I've heard before in focus groups, I mean, at least a lot of people I have heard talk about, you know, just the how unreliable the focus groups are. And I guess, like you said, compared to public reviews, you know, focus groups can be swayed. It can be dependent on how you ask the question. You can influence their answer. I mean, all this sort of stuff, right? And it's been our experience a lot of times, for instance, that we've had customers that say, we want to focus group a particular, you know, software feature to see what they think about it, right? Mm-hmm. And it could be, you know, it might be a very kind of informal internal focus group, but 99% of the time they show it to them and they just say, yeah, it looks good. All they really get is just positive. They don't get a whole lot of out of it, you know, some minor tweaks. You know, I don't know why that is exactly. I guess it's about how the questions they ask and how much sort of like they actually get to put their hands on it, you know, and use it. I think that can be more valuable if they've got time to really use it, and then they can say what they don't do or don't like about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, if you put an app out in the public marketplace on the App Store, you're going to get Apple reviews that tell you what people think of it. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to hold back.
Yeah.
When you look at your customers, what other technologies are kind of influencing outside of apps and software? What kind of technologies are influencing their markets or the decision-making process?
Gosh, most of the time, I feel like the challenge is with people's sort of limiting beliefs and their understanding of the marketplace. I think a lot of very powerful people have a lot of decision-making capacity, but haven't really done the due diligence in the market space. I think that that's the biggest challenge and the hindrance today. I also think going back to that industrialized legacy era of not being willing to try or venture out to do experiments, you know, trying to kind of be more empathetic in the shoes of your customer or your the other stakeholders in the organizations, or trying to do pilot programs that's a little bit outside of that standard best practices, I think are some of the challenges I think organizations are resistant or reluctant to, you know, we've always done it this way, let's just keep doing it this way. Mm-hmm. That's definitely the biggest challenge.
Gotcha. How are clients finding you nowadays? What's been kind of your most effective channel? I know you've been doing some speaking events I saw recently, and I think I saw you've been doing some webinars and stuff recently. How are those all sort of working out for you to raise awareness?
We're like mavericks. We are like a SWAT team. People either love us or really resist working with us, because we're going to change some stuff up. We're going to shake up your thinking. We're going to point out the inefficiencies. We're going to say things that you don't necessarily want to hear. So I think we draw the likes, you know, whether it's a client that is at a Fortune 500 that is feeling very discontented with how things are done, they can kind of bring us in and get things done quickly and inexpensively. Or if it's a smaller company that's really looking to disrupt and own, and, you know, they have big ambitions, those are typically the clients we work best with. If you want, you know, your play by the book, take order agency approach, you know, you define the scope and we execute. There's plenty of organizations that are happy to take those contracts.
Yeah, totally. Do you need kind of volunteering or service projects in the community that you're active with, and what you've been doing on that front?
I love our youth and our teens. I think that a lot of them don't feel very purposeful. I think there's a lot of misconception that you're a doctor, a lawyer, a failure. So, you know, being the 43-year-old and mother of two young children, I just want to go out and hug them all. Like, I've done a lot of speaking engagement with the Asian American Society. I've volunteered with the YMCA Young Achievers Program. I just want to hug them and tell them that they're going to be okay, that they're a gift, and that they are in the world to give that gift. And we as adults should help them find what their spark is. Just because my business, we work so innovatively with organizations and helping organizations overcome their limitations, I would love for young people to really find their spark and find their niche and know themselves, like know what drives them and what their motivators are, but also know the world that they're going to graduate into and how they can feel meaningful and purposeful and maybe create their own business or build their own career ladder, but feel that they are able to be effective, like feel empowered, versus I think a lot of teens today are very disengaged because a lot of the systems have failed them. And they're getting pushed to, you know, getting a job, or they're being pushed to go to college, or they're being pushed in one way or another. But they already have access to all this information that tell them, you know, you can become an influencer and make a lot of money. You can look at these people that are successful. And I think those are ultimately the wrong messages. And I work very hard with community organizations to offset that by, you know, helping kids, adults be more in tune with who they are and what they feel like is their value, and trying to be more purposeful, mindful, like you said, in terms of what they allocate their time and resources on, which is a lot of times their work.
Yeah, it's awesome. No, it's funny because you're dead on that. I don't know if it's even gotten worse, but, you know, you look at like TikTok. There are so many young folks, I think, that worry so much about how many views they're getting on TikTok, for instance, you know, because they're not TikTok famous or something, which, you know, so ultimately irrelevant, right? I mean, yes, there's those influencers out there, And yes, they can become brand influencers and such, you know, the very famous folks. But that's not really doing anything for your career and your job and or your purpose or your future, right? For the most part. And I've heard people say, you know, that their kids want to become a TikTok influencer, like that's their goal in life, you know, now, which is strange. We've lost the message a little bit there with that app, maybe.
So I have a lot to say about TikTok because my business is actually exploring a joint venture with the TikTok owners in China. Mm-hmm. TikTok in Chinese is called Douyin, and that is a very different platform than the TikTok in the United States because the two countries have very different regulations in terms of data mining and what you can do. Mm-hmm. So from a business B2B standpoint, if you look at Mead Johnson as an infant milk formula brand, I can use in China, not here in the United States, but machine learning to identify women that are self-disclosing that they're going to be pregnant or that they are in fact pregnant. And I can start marketing my product to those people. We call it pre-seeding, which is before they even go to the shelf, right? So P&G likes to talk about moments of truth, which is when you walk into Kroger's and you look at, you know, Abbott brand, Mead Johnson brand, infant milk versus what are you going to pick? But we can actually pre-influence them that on TikTok. So when you are sort of giving away that information for free, you know, that's the whole dynamic between advertisers and marketers and consumers. I'm just not going to go there. But I will say that for teens, so their attention span is shorter. This is, we all know this. I am, you know, on Instagram myself. And so I can't really blame the teens for wanting to be validated and wanting to make these funny videos or have voice over their existing videos. And they're really trying to be self-expressive and they want to be seen. And if you get to the crux of problems that they don't feel seen, that they want other people to validate who they are, that they're funny, that they're worth the extra likes or the click. And I think that that fundamentally is what we need to look at. I think that with the lockdown, a lot of us had to parent our own kids and we realize how challenging that actually is. But in fact, you know, from a child psychology perspective, you want to get to know your kid on a very deep emotional level. So when your child is on TikTok nonstop, you need to ask yourself, what are they missing? What emotional connections are they seeking online that they're not getting from their mom and dad or peers?
Interesting. Well, very cool and great point. So I guess to wrap up, what are the three main things that listeners might be struggling with that they should reach out to you for help with?
So I love that we ended on the TikTok note. So that is definitely an up and coming platform. If you're a business that's looking to leverage TikTok, or if you're a struggling parent that's trying to get your kid off TikTok, I would love to talk more. I see it as very much two sides of the same coin. You know, you can use this tool for evil or for good, just like when Mark Zuckerberg was put on the stand to say, how do you make your money? We sell advertising, but that same advertising and clamp down on false information can also help a lot of people. So I feel very much in that camp of, you know, let's not blame the tool. Let's look at how we can use it. And then the second thing is if your organization is really struggling with a challenge, you feel like there's a great opportunity out there, but you're just lacking the internal resources to deliver, whether it's product development, whether it's IT solutions, or you just want to be more curious about your industry in general, feel free to check out my website. It's sarahtaiconsulting.com. It has a slew of services that we can help deliver, and many of them are very custom. So we have a very flexible pricing package. We also have sort of a grab and go, ask and answer delivery process that can help you understand your industry, your competitors, and what the best practices is out there. So two things, I guess.
No problem. Well, great. Well, Sarah, thanks so much for coming on the show and talking to me about your background and what you do and what kind of problems you solve. You know, I think you've just got a wealth of information for people that they can tap into. So thanks again.
Thank you for the opportunity, Sam.
Thank you for tuning in to Unstoppable Talk. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. If you did, be sure to support the show by leaving a 5-star review on iTunes. And learn more about this show by heading over to unstoppablesoftware.com. Until next time, keep innovating.